What up? It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. My guest today is a fan favorite, friend of the show, of course, the executive director of the Pro Training Center in Clearwater, Florida, writes a podcast with True Hoop, and I haven't talked to him in this official capacity since a very fateful day several months ago. David Thorpe, coach, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good. Luckily, we're being entertained by some really terrific basketball. When we first last talked, I guess, I'm not so sure what we knew, what would happen. And I'm pleased at how things are going for the NBA.
Things are going pretty well. The playoffs are good. But the last time we spoke, I looked it up because I thought, man, you know, because you and I talk every so often, yeah. And we text every so often. I'm like, when did I last have Thorpe on the pod? I looked it up. It was March 10th.
Yeah, right after. I remember.
24 hours before Rudy Gobert and everything, which is wild. And at that time, we were speculating about whether they were going to start playing without fans and all this. And I listened to the first few minutes of it just to hear like what our tone was on that date. And I at one point say, quote, we have no idea where this is going, coach. Might be the most factual thing I've ever said. But you also made the point on that pod that day, March 10th, that if they played without fans, it wouldn't be that weird because these guys would just be used to it. And lo and behold, you were absolutely correct. We've seen it for the last few weeks. These guys, it's weird, I think, still for us, sort of used to it, sort of not. But for the players, the level of play doesn't reflect it. I think the excitement level might be a little different, but you certainly still see the intensity level. They're still getting texts for air punches, and we've still seen some flagrants and everything. Like, it's you can't really tell at that level that it's affecting the game. Although, and we'll get into this, we had a game 7 last night. Would it have looked and felt different in Denver as opposed to the bubble? Yeah, I think it would have. How that affects the outcome, I don't know. But I don't know. It's been interesting. Why do you think the games and the level of play have been so good despite all the time off, the lack of training that obviously was happening for 4.5 months, and being in this weird environment? How they've really been able to sustain quality playoff level NBA basketball?
There's a couple of things there. So first of all, I want to give credit to the league entirely for the product that they're putting out. I'm not a typical fan, obviously. I work with players that are playing in these games. I'm really close with executives and coaches that were long before he was involved in media. And so I don't watch the game as a fan. But I like being able to enjoy what I'm looking at and not just be an analyst. And I think the product is fantastic. And so in my office, I've got multiple TVs to watch a bunch of games, which I don't have to do anymore. It's only one game at a time, which is not typical of the case, obviously, for the NBA. But I'll have like the Tampa Bay Rays baseball game on or a hockey game, and dead. There's nothing. I mean, the hockey's intense and fast, but it's not the slick looking product we're seeing. Now, the players don't feel the same way we do, but I think it's my wife has watched it. Now that our kids are in college now, I don't have to be in my office. And this is one game when I go into our house and watch it, and she'll sit with me, and it looks cool. Like the way they do the video things. I think the NBA has done a really great job of that. So regarding the gameplay, what I said on your show, I remember being concerned about fans because I had players playing overseas that were already dealing with this kind of thing. And they're so used to this. You know the story, Howard, of like the famous game. There's two famous games. There's Team USA 1992 versus the college kids when Mike Krzyzewski feels like Chuck Daly threw the game to lose to Jamal Mashburn and Bob Hurley, junior, whatever, to lose on purpose in a sense, but the game was supposed to be very good. And then the more famous tilt, I think in Monte Carlo, where they played each other. And, the greatest game ever that no one saw. These guys are so used to competing, right? Whether it's AAU in front of nobody, their high school games and college games were well attended, those that played it. But AAU is very often played in front of nobody. And if college coaches can't come, really nobody. And practice too. So I think the time off healed their bodies. And I think that, I've written this at True Hoop, that initially when they came back, their skill game wouldn't be as good. Like LeBron's ball handling just came back like a week ago. He was not handling the ball very well. Shooting, I thought, was going to be the quickest thing to come back, only because in my gym, we opened up May 1st. I had an NBA player who played in the bubble, but he came in. And he made his 16 of his first 17 threes. And he had not touched the ball since March. This was May 1st. So I knew shooting wasn't going to be the problem. but everything else was a work in progress. So these guys, but their bodies are healthy. It's an athletic game. And so initially we saw that. We saw this energy and excitement. And the travel, being in the bubble has a mental impact that we'll probably get to. Paul George, of course, alluded to it publicly. But at least they're, as soon as they're done, and I've had players tell me this, they're in their training room and there is no travel. So that part from the head down, neck down, they're healing faster. They're healing better. And there's not much else to think about. There's no real distractions, which has a price also in terms of focus. But I will tell you the truth, Howard. I frequently forget where these games are. Every game, if you ever watch the game in my office with me, all I ever do is yell at the director of the TV saying, I don't care about the fans. If there's a game going on, I just want to see what's happening on the game. I can't stand the hero shot. I hate it. I know who made the shot. I saw the game. We have HDs now. All right. So I know no matter what I'm watching, I know who scored the basket. I don't need to see the close-up. And then I hate looking at his wife or the people in the stands. I just want to see the game. I want to see the initial because I'm a coach, right? So I am telling you, Howard, I forget all the time. The games are super intense. The guys guys are diving all over the place and knocking each other over like they would in any other game. So I think you make a really good point about Denver last night. Obviously, game sevens are pretty amazing. The fans are just as nervous. But we saw with the players, they were nervous as hell. That game was awful. This is the greatest offensive shootout of all time. The teams combined for 0 for 11 in the fourth quarter. The coach didn't sub. They were exhausted. It was awful basketball, but dramatic and suspenseful. It worked out just fine. I think so far so good. The NBA's got to be just – they don't want to celebrate. They've got to get everyone home with a championship awarded and say, we did it, but they are on their way, and it's really impressive to see.
It is. And listen, to your point, sure, it was an ugly game and a low-scoring game and, you know, kind of almost reminiscent in some ways different, but reminiscent of, you know, Lakers-Celtics Game 7, right. You know, Kobe's last championship.
Yes.
Where you mostly remember the dramatic elements of it. You don't necessarily think immediately, wow, that was tough to watch. And last night's game, because it's a Game 7, by definition, didn't even matter that it wasn't in Denver. It just felt intense and important. And like, it took a while before I even realized, I think it was my daughter actually was the first one who walked in, looked at the score. She goes, wow, this is a really low scoring game. And I went, oh, you know what? You're right. And it didn't hit me right off the bat because I think sometimes the drama and the intensity and the nerves that you're sensing, that is kind of what you feel as a viewer. And then later you realize, yeah, it's been played kind of at a lower level, and the score's way down from what we've seen in the bubble. It didn't matter. It was a fun game. It was a dramatic game.
Yeah.
And from the entertainment side, I don't want to upset your puritanism as a coach, but from a viewability factor or just fun.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree. I mean, it's always fun to see competition. When Mike Conley missed the last shot, and it looked like it was going in, which yes. only just hurt the Jazz worse, Donovan Mitchell was destroyed, which is exactly yes. how we should have felt. And it didn't matter if there were fans there. They're given everything they got, right? When Luka made the shot of the playoffs, you would probably say it was Luka's shot to win game four against the Clippers. I didn't think about fans for one second. And then the other night, Chris Paul at the end of game six, opposite the Rockets bench on a very bad offensive possession, he dribbled around for 15 seconds. He took a fadeaway three over Covington, falling out of bounds. I thought it was an air ball. I've seen a lot of shots in my life. I'm like, and I wanted to see him win a forced game seven. He switches it. It was so pure. I thought he airballed it at the bottom of the net. And when it went in, I didn't think about fans for one second. Now, that game would have been played in OKC, right? That would have been an unbelievable shot with fans who would have. It was a stunning shot, just like Luka's was. So I get that point. But all we can ask for is these athletes to give us everything they got and give themselves. And they're doing that. They are focused and hell-bent on winning.
So we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, the September 2nd. So we've got another Game 7 tonight, OKC, Houston. We've got Miami and Milwaukee. So we're not going to cover those necessarily. I do want to talk about last night's Game 7. Before I get to that, though, so we are, you know, near the end of the first round here. We haven't had anything terribly surprising yet, unless people are shocked by Miami winning game one, which I was not, or by the 2-0 lead of Boston over Toronto, which I don't think is that shocking. But so far, everything is more or less to form. Has anything that's happened in the bubble, both in the seeding games and the first round of the playoffs, has it changed anything that you believed about where this was all headed in terms of the actual contenders? Has anything surprised you at that level?
Oh, great question. I didn't think you'd ask that. You're such a good interviewer. Yeah, amazing question. First of all, I think you're right to say that there's been no real surprises. I've never gone 8-for-8. I've been doing this since 07 in the media. I've never gone 8-for-8 in a first round. If OKC wins tonight, I'm 8-for-8. I'm not sure I've done 7-for-8, to be honest with you. I'm pretty good at this. I think 6-for-8 is pretty standard, but I picked OKC in 7. I picked Denver in 7. So yeah, it's kind of gone as expected. I picked Miami before game one against Milwaukee. I still think Milwaukee can win the series. Even though I picked the Heat to win, I don't at all think that I'm definitely going to be right on this. Milwaukee played terribly, Howard. They were sloppy with the ball, and you can argue as to why they were sloppy. And Miami wasn't so sloppy, and they can be. Milwaukee got great performance from Middleton and Lopez. Giannis was obviously not so good, missed 8 free throws. I don't think that'll happen again. If it does, they're in big trouble. Bledsoe didn't even play. And he is their best perimeter defensive player on guards and would guard Dragic, who's playing incredibly well. I still think that series goes 6 or 7. And though I favor Miami, I wouldn't be at all surprised, obviously, if Milwaukee were to win that. The Lakers, I thought the Lakers and Milwaukee had the best chance to win when we restarted the bubble. I thought the Clippers had the best team on paper. We've never seen that team on the court. We still haven't.
No.
And so that's scary for the league, but also scary for the Clippers. Like, at some point, are we going to see their whole team? That counts for something, right? Although we see what Gary Harris gave a little bit of a lift to Denver guarding Donovan Mitchell, Pat Bev doesn't have to be fully back to do a decent job on Jamal Murray, right? They're not going to be operating at their highest level against Denver without Montrez being at full speed, without Pat Bev being at full speed. But the Clippers, to me, they're not as meshed as they need to be. They're the best team on paper, which I wrote back in October, probably all of us did. We haven't seen that team yet. We may not. And so now the Lakers have a duo that I thought would give them the advantage to win the West, because those two guys are better than any duo we've seen. And they have been, right? Davis and LeBron have been the best duo. The one change I would say to what I expected, I did not think Miami had a prayer to win, and I see a path for them now. It's not a great path. I wouldn't favor them. When I did, Henry always asked me a troop to do a playoff odds before the first round, and I gave OKC like a 3% chance and Houston a 2% chance, but there were only a few teams. Toronto had 11%, and then it was Milwaukee 30%, Lakers 30%, Clippers 22%. Miami deserves some percentage odds now. If they get through this round, they'll definitely be in there. They're playing incredibly well offensively in terms of their execution, Howard, the way they're running their offense. Going back to the seeding games in August, they've been doing this. And I've talked about it even then in terms of how they're running their team. They're executing better than anyone. And now you've got the Jimmy Butler factor. So he played so out of his mind in game one. I mean, he was shooting 4% from three, 24 before the playoffs. He played great in game one. If he can keep doing that, he doesn't have to do it all 7 games. Even 2 or 3 times. He's not one. Do it 1 or 2 times more. They're good enough to win at least 1 game without him against anyone in this in the league, right, left in the playoffs. So, yeah, Miami has turned some heads. Boston, to me, I always knew could be good. I don't like them long-term like I would Miami. I think Miami's defense, with their ability to have so many guys guarding top-level scorers, it's pretty hard to beat in the East.
So if Miami gets past Milwaukee, it sounds like you're ready to push them straight to the finals.
Well, I want to see what happens with Boston-Toronto. I like Toronto very much. Toronto is just not shot well. I'd love to tell you there's some inherent flaw in their system. The only mistake I think they're making is Siakam is trying to take Brown, Tatum, especially Brown and Smart, one-on-one. He just doesn't have that in his game. He was able to score on Draymond Green one-on-one. If you want to ISO those two guys, or Tatum too, which he's not trying, that's a mistake. But Nurse can fix that. Nurse can say, Pascal, stop. If you want to post, fine. Pass and cut when those guys are guarding you. We'll work on trying to get them not to guard you. They're guarding you for a reason. But I will say with Tatum, Smart, and Brown, that's three guys that is intriguing that can really guard. They're such a perimeter-based team. Tatum is so young. But, I mean, Kawhi was amazing at probably the same age to beat Miami that one year. Can Tatum be the best player on the court in a series? Maybe so. So I'd have to give Boston some serious – but I would probably favor Miami by 5% or something. It's close. Yeah, I love both those teams.
By the way, his new name, I believe, is Marcus Ray Allen Smart. Marcus, the greatest three-point shooter in the history of the game, Smart.
Yeah, people were tweeting that yesterday. Do you watch that game live?
I did.
So to me, this is why we watch the game. And when I coach, a lot of the drills that we do for shooting – they all are 3 in a row, 4 in a row, 5 in a row. I'll do a drill where I do first guy to make 12, but if you make 6 in a row, you win. Because I'm looking for the focus on those streaks. Human nature is to relax when you're being successful, and that's a mistake. And I don't mean you should get tense, but you should just stay locked in to whatever you're doing. So we train to go on hot streaks. That's what we do. So when you see it happening, when Smart, I think it was 5 in a row, including an and one from three. And he's not a great shooter, although I love Marcus Smart. It was just one of those things where like, okay, this is why I watch the NBA. To me, it's not about just the dunks or anything. It's that it's very hard to do that against air. Very, very hard against people, right?
That was a lot of fun. And that is why we watch, because you're sitting there on your couch or wherever you are, and you're just going, oh, wow, well, that was nice. Oh, wait, oh, there's a – oh. What the, you know, and even if you're in an empty room, you're still shouting out loud to nobody except yourself, because it's just fun to see that unfold, because it is the unexpected. We'll be back with more in a minute with David Thorpe. So let's linger on Siakam in Toronto for a minute, because Siakam has not looked like the same guy that we saw earlier in the season. Since they got to the bubble, they've tried to downplay it, which is the usual thing for teams to do and for coaches to do. No, we're not worried about him, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the reason that we still believe that Toronto had a chance and a path back to defending its title was that Siakam, at least for the first couple months of the season, was playing at, nearing an MVP level. He was in that you know, the silly early MVP discussions we have in November, December, he was on that list, right? And he had tailed off a little bit, but that team has a bunch of things going for it, but the one thing it does not have is that obvious go-to guy, which is normally how we identify contenders in this league. And Siakam, I thought, kind of needed to be that guy. Van Vliet is fantastic, and Kyle Lowry still Kyle Lowry, but like that's not the equivalent of Jimmy Butler or Kawhi or LeBron or saying, you know, go get a bucket at any time. What have you seen from Siakam? Does anything look off or different? Is it just that maybe we got too carried away earlier in the season with what he looked like he could do. And am I right? If Siakam is just the version we've seen the last few weeks, does that limit their ceiling for now?
Yeah. I mean, there's no question it does. I'm a big believer that the best offenses are run where you get good shooters wide open. I don't like the hero shots. I don't think that's smart basketball. I think it's a mistake that teams do it. I would argue last year, Kawhi was incredible, but they got no shot to even get to the finals, much less win it, if Van Vliet doesn't do what he's doing, right? You can't just have that guy, and you can't just go get a bucket against elite defenders. You can't against bad ones, and that's where I think Siakam is messing up. So as to why he's messing up, the only thing I can think of, we don't know about injury, it's possible, right, is Paul George gave everyone a gift. When Paul George admitted that this is hard on me. I've talked to players that have been there now, July 2nd or 3rd, whatever. Toronto actually was in Florida before that, down in Fort Myers, just south of me a little bit. They don't get a break. Like, they, you know, people are on Twitter today. What break do they need? They're millionaires and they're living at Disney. Sorry, you don't get to choose what stresses guys when all they're doing is basketball, basketball, basketball. There's nowhere to go, and they're not in prison, but they are imprisoned by they can't leave that bubble, and it weighs on you. My son, when he went to college at first, had to be quarantined. It sucks. Like, they are not quarantined in their room, but they're limited to where they can go. Same restaurants, like it's just wearing. And so it's possible that that is affecting Siakam. The argument I would, the coaching point I would give him is stop trying to score one-on-one in space against their best defenders. Let our offense help you. There's people criticizing Nick Nurse's offense for lack of imagination. They've always been fine. The players have to let the system work. Move, cut, screen, shot, fake, attack, kick, then shoot or shot, fake, attack again, whatever. Pascal in that environment would be much better. Remember, too, Toronto, I think, was number one in the NBA in transition offense, fast break points. I think LeBron's team is number two. And Boston is top three or top four at getting back. So that's helping. Boston is very focused on getting back, as they should. They're not, other answer is not even playing. They're not a good offensive rebounding team. And so that's helped mitigate Toronto's attack to some degree. Now Nick Nurse needs to adjust, but guys just needed to make shots, not just Pascal. They just missed a lot of shots, Van Vliet included. So I think there's a fix there. The problem is now you got to win four games in five, right? This is why Milwaukee, to lose to that Miami team again is a problem, because they're good enough offensively where you can't always just beat them when you play well, but it's just hard.
It's funny because normally when we say a team goes down 0-2 and we start citing all the stats about like whatever it is, 85%, blah, 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 win the series if they're up 2-0, whatever that stat is, that's not the right number.
Yeah.
But it's
a
high number. But that's usually because of home court advantage. It's probably mostly because the team that's up 2-0 was the better team to begin with, and they were probably the higher seed for a reason. You know, there's talent that goes into all this stuff too. But it is indicative of historical trends, right? 2-0 in the bubble might not mean as much. Needing to win four of the next five, but it's four of the next five all in the same place. And so it does throw a different kind of parameters on this. And, you know, even, you know, Denver became what I think the 12th team ever to come back from 3-1 and win a series. Part of that was that Denver was missing guys and they got Gary Harris back a couple games ago. And maybe that helped, you know, get them through that series. Part of it is that maybe Utah, you know, was a little better than expected, whatever, but there was no home court also. Does Utah ever go up 3-1 in the first place if they'd started that series in Denver? I mean, these are the things we'll never know. By the way, quick footnote, not that the NBA has listened to me on a single one of these little policy decisions. I disagreed with them disallowing us from, including the bubble games, the seeding games from our postseason awards. They should have counted. The NBA said no. I thought Jimmy Butler should have been able to wear his jersey with no name on it for symbolic reasons, as long as they were allowing other messages. The NBA just didn't do that one either. So I'm not expecting them to follow this either. And they've already made the decision. But there should be no home and away designations on this. I hate the idea that for all of history, we're going to say Denver won that game seven at home and it's going to factor into the stats historically. We're going to look at it when all of this fades over time. We're going to look at trends from this season and we're going to factor in home and away when there was no home and away. It's dumb. These should all just be labeled in perpetuity as neutral site games. I know the NBA is not going to do this, so they can just shoot me down again. But anyway, so let's talk about last night, game seven. Didn't matter that it was in the bubble. It was still exciting. It was still amazing. Low score and all. Jamal Murray. Can we just discuss for a minute Jamal Murray? 23 years old, fourth season, never been an all-star, never been all-NBA, and his averages this regular season, 18 points a game, shooting 34.6% from three, which is fine. Not great, not bad, just fine. 52% from two-point range. He missed the first four games in the bubble, the first four seeding games. And when he came back, when he finally got healthy, he scored 23, 14, 10, and 11. The 11 was in a short stint, but still. In seven playoff games, that same Jamal Murray is averaging 31.6 points, shooting 53% from three on 8.6 attempts. So not just some fluky low attempt stat. 56% from two. And of course, he just scored 221 points in that series, which is a Nuggets franchise record for a playoff series. And oh yeah, he had games of 42, 50, and 50 when prior to that, he'd only had two games over 40 ever, regular or postseason. Coach, these are the kind of moments where we get caught up in the excitement of it and we start making wild proclamations about the future of a player who does this. Is this a different Jamal Murray? Have you seen something new in him? Is this an indication of what's to come? Did he just make the quote-unquote leap with a capital T and a capital L?
Did you ever see the movie, the original Matrix?
Of course. many times.
So there's that. I've written an article about this long ago. Maybe it wasn't that long ago. Do you remember the scene when Neo thinks he's not the one because the Oracle told him you're not the one? But then he's fighting the helicopter and he's saving Trinity and he's doing all these spectacular things. And Lawrence Fishburne makes a comment and Trinity says, but he's not the one. And he said, there's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path. And so having watched the NBA for a long time, with the critical eye that I do now, I look for that. So there was a time when Kevin Durant knew the path, but he certainly wasn't walking the path, right? Even LeBron before that, Dwayne Wade, all these guys. I don't know that Jamal Murray will be able to continue to walk the path. He had never tried it. Like in this particular series, I watched every single game, every minute of every game. I thought going in, it was the most exciting series to watch. Jamal Murray started walking the path, which means you fight to get the open space shot. You can't always get it. And you keep taking it, right? And you keep challenging yourself to how much more can I go? There's a phrase I like to say when long ago my son was a young player in baseball. I would always challenge our team, and then he went on beyond me to be greedy. Like you score 4 runs the first inning, score 8. Like pour it on. And Murray got greedy in the best way. In fact, at the end of game 6, he made a big basket, and he said, I think to Torrey Craig, who had come to set a screen for him, he said, I don't need help. Meaning, if you bring a screen to me now, they might trap me and I might have to pass it. I don't want to pass it. Like, get out of my way, basically. I'm shooting the ball. And so, but I would argue, just like Magic pushed Bird and Bird pushed Magic, and I feel like what Donovan Mitchell was able to do, because going into the series, and I'm sure most of your fans who love the NBA know this, only Jordan and Iverson, two as iconic names as you can have in basketball, right, in the last 50 years, had scored 50 points twice in a series. And now these guys did it in the same series. And they're both younger than 25. I think one pushed the other. Donovan was otherworldly. And maybe that was a little less surprising. He did make the All-Star game. He's had big playoff series before. As a rookie, he really blew me away. He was much better than I thought Donovan was his rookie season in the playoffs. And I think that helped Jamal just say, screw it, I'm going to walk that path. And the path he walked was just shot making. He just has never been able to shoot like this. He was 70% at the rim going into game 7. He was 60% of mid-range. He was 50%+, as he still is, from 3. And he just kept doing it. It wasn't like he was doing it on, as you wrote, 8.6, as you said, 3 attempts a game. So now, as I like to tell players, you've screwed up, young man, because now we know what to expect. Like, we don't expect 34 a game from you next year. But this year, Jokic's usage percentage was 26% going into the playoffs this year, and Murray's was 24. And I actually thought it would be a bad thing if Murray starts feeling himself and trying to get to 26, 27, 28 at Jokic's expense. I was probably wrong. Well, first of all, I definitely was wrong in the series. The only reason why Denver made it to round 2 is Jamal Murray. End of story. Jokic was fine. I think Gobert may have outplayed him. It was a very, very good battle that no one realized was going on, because we couldn't take our eyes off the two guards. But the Jokic-Gobert battle was fantastic. And Rudy Gobert really stepped up in a way that I didn't expect him to do, especially offensively and then defensively in game 7. But Murray doing that made them better. And now if you're Mike Malone, you got to sit down with Jokic and you've got to, you know what? What I would tell him, not just the Clippers series, which I think might be a bloodbath personally, these guys are so exhausted. It's going to be 2-0 before they wake up, potentially. Maybe 3-0 before they wake up. I think Mike Malone in the offseason has to sit down with Nikola Jokic and say, we might have a superstar shooter on our hands. We might. I need to let him breathe a little bit, see where that goes. We'll use you in different ways. Just let us figure this out. You're still the fulcrum of our offense oftentimes. But you shouldn't be at every time. When you've got to somehow unleash him the way Steve Kerr unleashed Steph Curry a little bit. Is let's go find how good you can be, you know?
And here's the good news for Denver, though. If this really is the new Jamal Murray, if he just broke through, if this is a new level, and I think it's legit. I absolutely think it's legit. Maybe it's not those numbers don't hold me to the idea that he's gonna sustain those numbers.
Right.
That's not the point.
Right.
The point is whether or not he can be perennial all-star, whether he can be in the all-NBA discussion. He was not even, I looked it up, he was not even in the top 10 in voting at guard this year. if he can be this guy on some level, it makes the Nuggets, their long-term prospects are that much better, obviously. But I think in even better shape in this regard. The reason they've been a 50-plus win team the last couple of years is mostly about Jokic, yep, and a really great ensemble cast, right? A little Gary Harris, a little Will Barton, a little Jamal Murray, a little bit of all these guys, right. Millsap. But if Jamal Murray can be that guy and be the focal point, and Jokic doesn't have to be, the thing with Jokic is you could see this about his game and in his personality, and he's talked about it. He doesn't want to go out there and necessarily be like, all right, give it to me. I'm going to go, take every shot, or I'm going to be the one to carry us home in the fourth quarter. That's not the way he's built. It's not his mentality. It's not that he doesn't have the skill set, and it's not that he doesn't want to win. It's just he's not that alpha dog type that we talk about in the NBA all the time, and I do think that that kind of matters, and Jamal Murray just showed that he is. Plus, you know, yes, Jokic creates in a way that very few seven-footers have in right. history, but not the same way that a guard can create. And I look at that, and then I'll take it one step further, because Michael Porter Jr., granted, pretty quiet series, but was so great in the seeding games. He showed why he was once considered a top three type pick before the back injury. I mean, I, again, I'm going to fall right into like stupid NBA pundit guy here, but are we seeing the emergence of a possible big three? Because Porter has that skill set, and he's like, a 6'9", 6'10", with ball handling skills and shot making skills. They'll have to figure out the pecking order and all that stuff. But I feel like they now have three potential pillars there.
Well, so you raised some interesting points. Jokic is funny, and I'll bring it in the show today. I did with Henry. We actually showed the video of Jokic's game-winning shot where he goes to shoot the hook. Gobert guards it. He pivots away. He's looking around to pass it. Nobody wanted the ball. Nobody was moving. And mostly they were just too tired. So it was almost like, oh, I guess I'll shoot the hook shot. And he made it because he's super skilled. But he'd have been happy to pass that ball. And they're great yes. because of it. It's like playing with Joe Montana. Like, just, dude, get open. He will find you. He'll know you're open before you are. He gets a bucket every game almost by leading a guy to a bucket didn't even know they had. If Murray can shoot like this is the question mark about him. And that's why I talked about green lighting him some. Let him go. Denver has 20 games to play with a little bit next year. Let's just see what Jamal can do for us. Although I will say Jokic has got to attend him better on defense. They had to take him out twice in the last 90 seconds or so in the game to play Plumlee. You don't want to do that with your best player that's that kind of skilled offensively. A free throw shooter, the whole thing. He can get better. Now that he's changed his body, he can make it more dynamic going forward. The Porter Jr. thing is where I think it's going to get hard. It's easy to fall in love with his skill set. It's easy to fall in love with his athleticism. It's also easy to fall in love with his story, right? Best player coming out of high school, injured for all these years. Howard, it is so hard to play anywhere close to Kevin Durant. I think we can agree Kevin Durant is much better than Paul George, and Paul George is fantastic. And the difference between that Paul George and, Michael Porter Jr. is the Indian Ocean, right? It's the Pacific. It's enormous. Why? Not as skilled yet. Right now, Porter's mainly just a catch and shoot guy. Can't really dribble. Dribble's okay in air, in space. In traffic, sure. I wouldn't trust him like Durant. Getting his own shot and making it, I wouldn't trust Agreed. It. No clue how to play. I mean, a player in Orlando said that to me. If he ever learned how to play, he'd be dangerous. Well, it's hard. It's not so easy to really learn and continue to work on your skill game and your athleticism. However, there are 99.9% of players in the world who, even with a ton of work and basketball IQ, they can't be as good as Michael Porter Jr. can be. I mean, he does have that raw ability. Denver should be investing lots of resources this offseason to make sure he takes another leap. And then he's got a few years to do that. Took Durant. I think in year three of Durant, he was still a negative plus minus for the first year of the Thunder. Whatever his I don't know if he played in Seattle 1 year or two, but in year three, which definitely was in OKC, he was negative plus minus. The team was better when he was off the court. So it's hard to be good at this game and actually impact wins. You put up numbers, but to impact wins when you're on the court. So if Porter Jr., we think he's got a chance, he has a long way to go, but you're not wrong. If he becomes this lights out shooter, bucket getter, and she should not be a defensive liability. He's long and athletic. with Murray and then this brilliant glue guy in Jokic, who is an MVP level candidate offensively, with Jeremy Grant is going to, you know, be great there. He Millsap started and was a non-factor and a bad player, actually. Jeremy Grant was a winner for them. They've got an interesting group. The West is absurdly loaded. We'll talk about that in the offseason. But they're just another team that's going to get better in the offseason, probably.
And shouts to Tim Connelly and his staff. And, of course, Arturas Karnisovas, who had been there before the Bulls hired him. They've just done such an incredible job that getting Jeremy Grant from Oklahoma. Yep. Obviously, the drafting they've done. It's funny. We talked about this on the pod a couple weeks ago that, you know, the Nuggets helped build the Jazz, right? Like the picks that were used to take Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell were once Denver Nuggets picks. And we don't even talk about it because we don't look at those as mistakes when you've done such a phenomenal job all around everywhere else. The Jamal Murray pick, mid lottery. Obviously Jokic in the second round, taking the flyer on Michael Porter Jr. and that looking like it's going to pay off. The deals that got them, Gary Harris and Will Barton. And they're just so deep. And here they are with two potential perennial all-stars. Jokic already is. Jamal Murray could be. We'll leave Porter to the side for a moment, but whatever he may become, there's a high ceiling there. But in the meantime, you've still got this collection of all these others, you know, the Monty Morrises and the, you know, the Grants and everybody else. They've just done a really nice job of creating a deep team of guys who will always give you something, no matter, you know, where you plug them in. They're versatile. You can mix and match a lot. And you know, that gives them a lot of cushion. And to your point about Michael Porter Jr. being light years behind or an Indian Ocean behind Paul George, sure, but they also don't need him to be that guy as long as Jamal Murray is going to be the guy that we just saw, right? So if you're the third wheel, you got all the time in the world to develop into whatever you may become. I really love the upside there. Okay, there's more Full 48 with David Thorpe, so stick around. Another game 7 tonight, so we obviously do not know what is going to become of Oklahoma and Houston, but I do think we've seen a lot in these first six games, including the closing minutes, of course, of game 6. We've had almost 48 hours now of blame game, Russ, you know, ball dominance and you know, air ball and turnovers and Harden looking detached in those crunch time minutes. Is it about Westbrook? Is it about Harden? Is it about Mike D'Antoni not making sure that his best player has the ball in his hands? These are, to an extent, kind of the same old issues, right? Like for the Rockets, playoff flameouts, whether it's against the Warriors or somebody else, it always comes down to, are they overly reliant on Harden? Is Harden coming up in big moments? Kevin O'Connor at The Ringer had a great piece about Harden and all this and some of the stats on him in crunch time. What did you see in that game in particular? What do you think it tells us about the Rockets in particular? Because the Thunder, you know, whatever the Thunder do, if they advance from the series, it's all just a joyride. Nobody expected them to even make the playoffs. But the stakes for the Rockets are big.
They're big, yeah, because it's a reference point back to the trade for Westbrook to begin with, right? That's kind of part of the narrative. I think Russell Westbrook, first of all, it's hard to miss as much time as he did. And then I just don't think they should play him as much. Part of the problem is he should be on the bench. And I know, oh my God, but yeah, I thought they looked better without him.
Did you see him? Another coach texted me about this. You could see him while he was out there earlier in the fourth quarter. He's starting to pace and yap, and you can't see what he's saying, but it looks pretty obvious. He's saying, get me back in there. Yeah. I had like a 15-0 run without him, and he's basically like carping to get back in there, as superstars do, and they kind of have that right. But to your point, maybe you shouldn't have.
He's not a superstar anymore, not like that. And he missed some time. Like, it's one thing I've noticed too is guys that are missing parts of these seeding games, not to mention playoff games, they don't have 4 months behind them of playing all the time to kind of get back on the wagon a little bit. They've got to start over. They really were out. There was no competitive games for so long. And I think that's rang true a little bit with Westbrook. I don't know who's in charge of late game decisions. You'd think D'Antoni would be, but Harden may be. But I mean, Westbrook had the ball in his hands a ton and Harden didn't. And that's just odd to me. I will say, to me, the most intriguing thing about Game 7 is what they do with Lu Dort. Dort, 7-38 from three, atrocious in their two losses that he played in, because he didn't play in one of the losses. However, he's 10-17 from two, not a lot, obviously, in five games that he played, but he is wearing Harden down some. He's not stopping Harden. He is a powerful. He looks like a linebacker, defensive end, with the quickness of a tailback, right, or a little point guard. He's this energetic, athletic, powerful figure who's like a puffed up younger version of Marcus Smart. Like that.
I was thinking that.
That is not an easy guy to score on. It requires energy. And so if you don't play him, Harden might be fresh or late. If you do play him, in my opinion, you can't let him shoot threes. It's just likely to be missed. The numbers are in. You're open. During the regular season, keep shooting so we can evaluate you and learn. There's no learning in game seven. We can't afford any wasted possession. So in my opinion, unless you get the ball with 2 seconds on the clock, don't shoot the three. Screen, cut, screen, cut, screen, cut. That's what I'd be telling Dort to do all the time. And then guard Harden the other way. On the other end, Westbrook in the post is fine. Westbrook as the primary ball handler, not fine. And remember this, I don't know that Houston's played a dud game. I have to look, it's been 2 weeks. These games are, it's 14-day, a seven-game series. I don't remember they've had it because they're capable of having a terrible game. They shoot a lot of threes. They're capable of missing a lot of threes. OKC has been pushing pace. People don't realize it. They're moving. Chris Paul's moving. They're just not looking to rush taking a shot. They're trying to wear Houston down. OKC really believes we're going to win most of those close games. And they had the best record in the league. I think they were 30-15. I'm guessing that, but I think that's what I remember looking up in the regular season and crunch time games, close games. 30-15, best in the league. It's in their identity. They have the smartest point guard in the league in Chris Paul. Like they've got a feeling like, Portland, I remember Damian hit a big shot against the Lakers in game one and Nurkic pointed to his wrist, Dame time. That's an identity. The OKC thinks we own the last few minutes, and Houston historically has not been great, as you referenced, and that's going to play in too. So OKC wants to muck it up, ugly things up, right, be around late and execute down the stretch. The fact that Westbrook has the ball in his hands only makes that more problematic for Houston. I think he's going to play great tonight personally. I don't know how he'll play late in the game, but we've seen Westbrook as the ultimate warrior. He'll block a shot and do a Hulk, and he'll get a dunk and an and one, and he knows how to push those buttons on himself, but I don't trust him late in games. The ball should be in Harden's hands late.
There's no question about that, and this is what's so maddening, I think, when you're watching a game like this and seeing these are things we knew at the moment they made the trade. At the moment they made the trade, and I've obviously been on record as being critical of that deal from the start, and I understand it was as much or more about Chris Paul and James Harden dynamics than it was about anything else, but Chris Paul was the better co-star, was the better, more complimentary player next to Harden because he can make open shots both from two and from three because you can't leave him open. I thought that they were the more complimentary pairing. But they went down this road, and this is exactly what I would have feared. Not only Westbrook's liability as a shooter or in other ways, but also he's best with the ball in his hands. Well, if the ball's in his hands, then by definition, it's not in James Harden's hands, and James Harden is the higher percentage guy from everywhere on the court. Yeah. And is the guy who's going to manipulate a defense to the point where if he can't get the open shot, he's going to have somebody open that he's going to hit. And for Harden to be shut out of those possessions that end with an air ball, that end with turnovers, if you're a Rockets fan, you must be pulling your hair out. I don't know where to point the finger on this. Is that a two stars who worked it out amongst themselves? And in today's NBA, you kind of just have to like roll with, if Harden's going to defer to Westbrook on those, then I guess you live with it. Or is that the coaching staff? Should Mike have even put Westbrook back out there? And then once he is back out there, should it have been really clear Harden's got to be the one? Now, somebody else said to me, listen, the one thought could be that if Harden's got the ball in his hands at the beginning of the possession, immediately, the defense is going to be completely focused on him. They're going to try to take it out of his hands or whatever. And so at least you can work the offense in a way where he's going to get it later. But it never happened, of course, because Westbrook torched those possessions. Is there a right and wrong in this discussion somewhere? Like, we could all agree Harden should have had the ball in his hands, but I guess it comes down to whose mistake is it that he didn't?
It would also comes down to when does he get the ball in his hands? If we can both agree that he should have the ball in his hands, the question is when in the possession. So in basketball, we have what we call second side and third side. Okay. It's not really taught very well in high school, much better in college and certainly the pro. In Europe, it's a big deal. The court is super tight in Europe. The players are not quite as athletic. Obviously, they have American players there. They have athletic Europeans too. but it's not the dribble drive game that we have here so much. So you got to play second side. So let's say the ball is on the right side of the court. Second side, we throw it to the left side. Then you bring it back to the right side. The Jazz do this a lot. It's some of the good offensive teams, when they're not getting selfish, do second side, third side action. I've been saying this for a long time, and in particular this series, neither the Rockets or the Thunder are playing much second side, third side action, and they should, because they both have elite. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Dennis Schroeder are impossible to guard one-on-one if you go second side, third side. They are jets. But if you just give the ball to them and space out and stand there, well, everyone knows where the Jets coming to, and you can build your defense around it. So I'm disappointed both teams aren't doing the second side, third side, or what we call false motion, action on the weak side of the court to occupy defenders. So if you're the Rockets, Westbrook should not be a primary ball handler anymore. I argued in an article I did last summer, he should be in the pinch post. Well, instead of the pinch post, he actually is back and diagonals in the wing. He's done it before. That's fine, but not on the perimeter. But still, make sure you get some action going where the ball ultimately arrives in Harden's hands, unless Westbrook has a wide open paint shot or layup. Of course, I mean Westbrook. That'd be fine. They've got to get more movement, open the Thunder defense, and then you can see, you know, Harden shredding anyone. If you just give him the ball for four quarters against Lu Dort and the other four dudes all focusing, that's going to wear Harden down, which is what we've seen. The other thing is they're tiny. Like Covington's their tallest guy, Tucker's their biggest guy at 6'5 in terms of strength. And Steven Adams is an enormous man who's an athlete, and he knows how to use his bulk to wear you down. So there's not just aerobic activity wearing you down. There's the anaerobic thing. And if you ever boxed or wrestled, you understand the anaerobic impact. It wears you down physically to wrestle. And watch, Adams goes after every offensive rebound. He's done an amazing job. Even when he has no shot, he's making an effort. Why? Because he's forcing Covington and Tucker to hit him. And that takes a toll on them. He's way bigger than them. So again, this goes back to what they're trying to do. Win the fourth quarter. Keep it close. Win the fourth quarter because they're mentally, physically, emotionally exhausted by having to deal with Lu Dort on the perimeter, Steven Adams, and so all these kinds of things make a difference. Now, Harden can go crazy the way Marcus Smart did. Harden can make five straight threes in a quarter for sure, right? He might get two and ones, but it's hard to do that when you're tired. Smart wasn't so tired. That's why I think the Thunder have a real shot here is the Rockets, I think, are tired, and I don't know what's playing in their head. Westbrook could really give them some energy early, and it'd be great if they did, and then get the ball to Harden later on after that, let him do his thing. That's what I would do.
I'm guessing by the time most people listen to this podcast, because we're recording on Wednesday afternoon, that game may well be over. We'll know, you know, the listeners will know who won between those two. But I'm thinking ahead already, as I'm sure a lot of people are. That
the Lakers.
Well, there's one, the Lakers, yeah. Who I think are definitely beating either one of these teams. Sure. You know, the idea with Westbrook Harden was, you know what? They're both such dynamic individual forces. Hopefully, you know, we channel it in a way that this, you know, the combination of that unusual 1-2 punch and the small ball will catch somebody off guard, will catch fire at the right time, whatever, will overcome lack of size, will overcome other deficiencies or the fact that they're not the best fitting superstar tandem. If Westbrook even is a superstar anymore, as you've said, he's not. But it's either coming to an end tonight, or it's coming to an end soon against the Lakers. And then the Rockets are going to have to decide not only about D'Antoni's future, which it already seems like that's already decided. He's a lame duck for a reason.
Right.
But now they're going to have to face reality. Westbrook's another year older. He's got a skill set that doesn't age well, or a play type that doesn't age well because he relies so much on his athleticism. And now it's back to, well, then if not him, then who? Can you even trade him? Would you want to trade him? Can you prop up the supporting cast? I mean, I don't know even know where they turn from here. But before we close out here for the day, any thoughts on? And I know, folks, I'm writing their obit too soon, and maybe they'll have one game seven by the time you're listening. But where do the Rockets go, assuming that this thing is either over by now, or will be over soon?
So it seems like I agree with you. I think D'Antoni is not coming back. I would be making a lot of phone calls to the Knicks, trying to see if they'll take Westbrook. It seems like if anyone would do that, it'd be them, for reasons that you understand probably better than most. It wouldn't be a smart move, but that's exactly why I think the Knicks is. I think Daryl Morey's probably got him a speed dial now. I still think that you can run a lot of offenses with James Harden and Russell Westbrook. I don't love this one they're doing. They can be a little bit more conventional. it's better for Harden to be, I mean, he's wearing down and they've had 4 months off, right? It's going to be same thing next year if it's a regular season without another pandemic break, which I'm hoping for. Go find a center. You know, there's lots of options out there. Play more, you know, run a different offensive system. Have another primary ball handler that's more of a quarterback decision maker, not someone like Westbrook that'll just take a bunch of bad shots. They've got some good pieces, but they need Daniel House is good, but I'm not sure he's a long-term starter. I don't trust Ben McLemore. I don't trust Austin Rivers. I never have. Maybe I'm wrong. We'll find out, you know, both when they play tonight and next series, if they win tonight, I just don't see them long-term. I think they've got a real overhaul to do. And I think Daryl Morey is amazing. I've said that many times. He's got a great eye for talent. His analytics department clearly is great. But I think they need to stop playing this way, which I think they will. And nothing against his style. And D'Antoni or somewhere else would be great. But I think for what they have on this team, they need to play differently than how they're playing now.
Agree on all that. The supporting cast, I mean, credit to D'Antoni and credit to Daryl Morey. Like, they've found guys who do play well off of James Harden, and they've gotten the right kind of players. But it's such a low ceiling supporting cast. There just really isn't much else there. Obviously, they haven't gotten enough from Eric Gordon in this series as well. And I don't know where else they turn at this point. But they've had Harden for a pretty long stretch here now. You know, we can say it's about the Warriors, and in part it is, but still. When you've got a player of that caliber, one of the best scorers we've ever seen, and, you know, an MVP and a perennial MVP candidate, you know, whether they're losing, whether they've lost by now, by the time listeners hear this, or whether they're losing in the second round, that's not the outcomes that you can sustain for very long before something has to give. Either the star goes or everybody else goes. And I don't know. I have a feeling we'll be talking about the Rockets for the next few months, regardless of what happens tonight.
Well, so. and let's just say, like the Clippers, the Lakers are recovering. They probably took 2 or 3 days off of basketball, go fish, go play tennis, walk the park, whatever, wear a mask. Let's forget about basketball as best as we can. Family can come in. Although I feel badly for those that I told you on a text. Anyone that's got kids that aren't toddlers, those kids are in school or on sports teams. Like, they can't just come to the bubble so easily. So it's almost unfair for the older players like LeBron. His son can't take 5 weeks off or whatever. He's trying to train to be a great college player or whatever. So I think that I think L.A. is just mentally recovering. And it, just like Denver, it's going to be 2-0 before they wake up. As long as L.A. plays well, plays hard, because whoever Houston or OKC is going to be a little bit delirious.
Yeah, so Clippers-Lakers conference finals, which is what we've been talking about since like a year ago July, and it very much looks like we're on track for that. And the only bummer of that is that we're not all getting 14 days in LA just repeatedly going to Staples Center while they change the court out, and we all like that. Everybody who covers this league, everybody was looking forward to the idea of an all LA conference finals, and we're going to get it. It just won't be in LA. It will be in Orlando or whatever. It's a Lake Buena Vista,
yes,
or whatever.
Lake Buena Vista, yeah.
Before I let you go, I mentioned obviously you can catch all of Coach Thorpe's work on True Hoop podcasts and articles as well. And you guys should subscribe if you haven't. But I know you're also launching an app soon for virtual player development. Is this for the average player as well as the pros? Like, who's
no.
where will they be able to find this app?
Yeah, and at the pro, yeah. We're just working on it now. ThePro TrainingCenter.com. It's for anyone that wants to get better at basketball. Most of our subscribers will be players that want to get better. We'll have parents. I've done this for a while, and I've just never had an app before where parents want to help their kids. Coaches, a lot of coaches subscribe. And it's also great to get in shape, but that's, I don't think we're there yet. Mostly it's for players that want to get better. Basically, it's what I do with my pros in the offseason. ThePro TrainingCenter.com. I appreciate you asking me about that.
No, absolutely. So folks, look for that soon too. If you want to train like a pro, get all the benefits that all the pros get from Coach Thorpe, there you go. It'll be available to you on the App Store and other app
places. Very soon, yes, sir. Yep.
Very soon. Awesome. Coach, this has been great. I'm glad we got a chance to do it. Catch up finally. It was too long. That's my fault. The next gap hopefully will not be quite as long nor as dramatic.
Yes. I look forward to seeing you and hugging you in person, Howard.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Be safe, my man.
You too.